we're so used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatment of animals.
Yeah, the less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
Everyone eats, and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table.
Welcome to the Animal Voices radio show, Western Canada's only radio program on animal advocacy and compassionate living. This is 100.5 FM Co-op Radio CFRO in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Today is Friday, July the 1st, 2016. Happy Canada Day. I am your host, Allison Cole, and I am joined here today by our co-host, Caroline Carnery.
Hello there.
And Jen Dobell.
Hello.
And we have a guest co-host, David Espister, in the studio today. Hi, David.
Hello.
Thanks for coming. Welcome, everyone. So this is the time of year that animal advocates in Canada are thinking about the rodeo, and so are we here at Animal Voices. The annual Calgary Stampede, Canada's largest rodeo festival, starts next week, and so this means another 10 days of precarious animal abuse events that will inevitably result in multiple deaths of animals, as they do every single year. Today on the show, we'll be speaking about our impressions of the part of society that fervently upholds the rodeo tradition, as well as discussing singer Jan Arden's controversial involvement in the Stampede Parade this year. Why controversial? Because she considers herself an animal advocate. And as was recently announced by the United Egg Producers in the United States and here on Animal Voices, the egg industry in the U.S. has declared that it will stop the egregiously cruel practice of grinding up live day-old male chicks in the egg industry by the year 2020. The new standard will save the lives of 260 million chicks in the U.S. alone every year. The nonprofit organization, the Humane League, was instrumental in the negotiations with the United Egg Producers to implement this ban on chick culling, and we'll have Executive Director David Komenheide of the Humane League here on the show for our feature interview to tell us all about it. That interview is coming up in about 32 minutes, so please do stay tuned. Now, as well as being Canada Day today, July 1st also marks a celebration of Sanctuary Day. So it's Sanctuary Day today. Isn't it a day to celebrate?
It is so, Allison. And I wanted to just talk a little bit about the importance of sanctuaries. Most of us are familiar with the farm sanctuary in New York State, which started in 1986. And that sanctuary has given rise to sanctuaries all over North America, inspired many people to help rescue animals. And I feel that they're so important, not only to the animals that have been rescued, because they get to live out their lives in this protected environment after a long period, in many cases, of abuse and neglect. But also, sanctuaries provide really important education and a way for average people to interface with real live animals that they would have otherwise considered food. Now, these are farmed animals with actual names. So a family trip to the sanctuary can actually be the very first time that children ever meet animals in person outside of the family, cat or dog.
It's so true, Caroline. And I know that you visited an animal sanctuary. Was that your very first time last month?
It was. And we visited Rasta Sanctuary on Vancouver Island. And I did so. We set our GPS coordinates for that after the NARD event in Victoria, based on the advice of Mark Hawthorne, who we had as a guest here on the show, and is a well-known vegan and animal rights author. And also he spoke at Animal Advocacy Camp. And he said, sometimes you have to go and get FaceTime with the faces you are saving. And it was so heartwarming. And although she's very, very quick to say, Lynn Cerny, the operator of Rasta Sanctuary, to say that this is not a petting zoo, there was a whole lot of hugging and petting going on, let me tell you, and a healthy amount of education. You don't get the tour without the education about what has happened to these animals and what is happening to animals. And which leads me to, you know, my next point, you know, this education that people get and these inspiring stories of animal rescue and being able to make that human connection. And also for us activists, just really being able to heal ourselves by visiting healing animals.
I've been to many sanctuaries myself, and I really do like it when the tours, they always, usually sanctuaries will set up tours for just, you know, the average family to take their kids to so that they can enjoy a day visiting animals. And I really appreciate the sanctuaries that really put the animal rights message into their tours. So for example, they'll show some chickens that were rescued from the layer industry, like we'll be talking about later today, and speak about their lives of how they live cramped in cages and now they're free to live out the rest of their lives. So these animals are really ambassadors for the part of society that most of us, we don't get to see. And people who eat animals, they don't get to have that FaceTime, as you mentioned, with actually their food, right?
Now, Allison, I want you to tell us about, you have a very, very powerful, heartwarming story, and I'd like you to share it.
Yeah, I mean, this story is actually, it's been shared online, and I actually had the pleasure with my sister of meeting this wonderful calf last year at Poplar Springs Sanctuary in Poolesville, Maryland, which is near Washington, D.C. His name was and still is Moses, and he was born on an Amish dairy farm last year in Pennsylvania, and once a week, the veal truck would stop by to load up the cow's babies and take them away to slaughter, but this baby's mother, he was named Moses, actually. She had lost countless babies before, and she didn't want to lose this one, so when she saw the familiar truck making its way up the road, this has happened before. I've heard of these stories happening before with mother cows. She hid her tiny calf to keep him safe from the farmer. So it worked. Moses was missed. He didn't make it on the truck to the slaughterhouse or to the veal farm where he would be slaughtered very soon. And he was given the name. I finally learned this week why he was given the name Moses. And it's because this mother, just like in the biblical story, she brought her son to safety. And just like in the biblical story where Moses's mother made a raft for Moses and put him down the river and never to know what would happen to him again. And this is a happy story because this baby, he was actually just sort of abandoned by the farmer and left to, who knows what kind of fate. And this woman found him and confronted the farmer and convinced him to let her take him away. And she brought him to safety. And now he lives at Poplar Springs Sanctuary. We got to visit him. He was about 2 months at the time last summer. He was the most adorable little calf. And I have a quote here from last year's story that made it into the Dodo saying, "He's a very sweet little cow. And he's friendly, he loves people, and loves to lick them." And my sister actually fell in love with Moses. If anyone knows my sister and goes onto her Facebook profile, that's her profile picture still with her and Moses. And it's so beautiful. And I said to her last night, I said, "Oh, did you know that Moses loves to lick people?" And she goes, "He still does." So I guess she got some licks. He was sweet. And then I found a video of him also from last year of him mooing. And I remember how much my sister just loved that because this is how he moves. He goes, "Moo." It's just like that. It's the most endearing thing. And I was happy to see a most recent photo of him just from this spring. He's a big boy now, and he's able to live out the rest of his life there on Poplar Springs Sanctuary. And that sanctuary is actually, I deem it to be one of the happiest places on earth because all the animals there, just like other animal sanctuaries, they live in peace. And they're able to just, you know, live out their lives as they should, right?
As they should, as it should be. Yeah. And we don't have to go all the way to Pennsylvania.
Well,
thank
he lives
you.
In Maryland.
Or
now.
Maryland now. But yeah. That story started in
Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
Thank you. And but we've got a number of sanctuaries within locally, driving distance for sure. of us. And I think we should mention them because they take volunteers. So if you want to actually contribute physically with your effort, we've got Happy Herd in Alder Grove. We've got Hearts on Noses, and they've got over 40 pigs here in Mission, BC. So right here at home.
Rasta Sanctuary on the island.
Of course, Rasta, which I mentioned.
And I just wanted to put just little call out for people who want to support Rasta. They recently, we had them on the show. We featured Lucy on the show to talk about Rasta last fall? It was within the last year. If you want to go to animalvoices.org, you can listen to that interview. It's really interesting. And Lucy moved all of the animals from Alberta to Vancouver Island for a better life. And now she's really working hard to rebuild her sanctuary. So she needs funds for that. So if you're able to make a tax deductible donation to Rasta, they are a charity. You can go onto our Facebook page and find a link for that. I posted it there yesterday. It's Animal Voices Vancouver.
Hey there, Co-op Radio listeners. Do you like food? Of course you do. Would you like to learn more about food? Why not? Well, then tune in every Monday at 8 p.m. for Food Line Radio, where we talk all about food, sourcing food, buying food, the politics of food, hey, even cooking food. Food, glorious food. Listen every Monday at 8 p.m. for Food Line Radio on Vancouver's Co-op Radio 100.5 FM.
And now for our local events. Local animal rights activist Patricia Talman is hosting an educational forum about how our food choices impact the environment, and she would like you to invite your omnivore friends. The event takes place Friday, July 8th from 1 to 2:30 at the Kitsilano Community Center. You can register at www.kitscc.com. Local animal rights activist Megan Beatty is hosting an event tomorrow at 7 o'clock in the morning. The event takes place at Kitsilano Beach and is called Chalk Kits Up. Activists can buy sidewalk chalk at dollar stores and decorate the seawall and other areas with messages of love for animals. Information can be found on the Facebook event page entitled Chalk Kits Up, and the meeting will be at the foot of U Street at the beach. If you have an animal-friendly event that you would like to have announced on the show, please send us an email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com or put it on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver.
The horn sounds and the charge is a quick one for Ray Mitzwing up that two barrel with West Oilfield. Oh, Mitch Sutherland comes off the one barrel, two wheels and onto the track right alongside.
So it's rodeo season here in Canada with the biggest annual rodeo event, the Calgary Stampede, coming up soon from July the 8th to 17th. It attracts 1 million visitors every year, and this 10-day festival has been happening since 1912. It's dubbed the greatest outdoor show on earth. So exactly how great is this show, especially for the animals who are featured in it in various demonstrations that are supposedly representative of the work in animal ag, and who are the people who take part in this rodeo culture? Now, we are an animal advocacy program, so of course, from our perspective, we always are looking out for the side of the animals. And what that side involves is that many rodeo events use fear, stress, or pain to make the animals perform. It's a fact, and these methods are used in events such as calf roping, bull riding, and the chuck wagon horse races, just to name a few. These events are dangerous both for people and the animals. And at the Calgary Stampede itself, there have been numerous deaths of horses, for example, in the chuck wagon races, with over 60 deaths since 1986 alone. Now, I don't come from rodeo culture myself. I know that you, Jen, and you, David, you don't. Caroline, your story's a little bit different here. But for me, someone who's just a real, like, outside bystander or onlooker, I guess you could say, to this whole cultural tradition, it really just baffles my mind to understand what the purpose of this all is. How do you three feel about it, just being people who haven't been involved, and then we'll talk to you, Caroline.
I'm fired up, Allison.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, to me, I know I said to you recently, like, I feel like an alien here on Earth. I really do when I'm looking at the rodeo, because I've been learning about it lately. What do you think, Jim?
Yeah, these kinds of events make me feel more and more misanthropic as I learn more about what they actually do to these animals in order to make them perform the way that they do. And this is something that's typically hidden from the public and even from the TV cameras.
And, you know, again, I mentioned tradition. We're a species that values tradition. The people in the ranching community have valued this tradition, that it's supposed to showcase the methods that they use with animals in ranching, the rodeo. But, David, that's not true, is it?
No. I mean, I obviously would like to state first and foremost, I object to it in every way, of course, like we all do here. But that argument is such garbage. Many of the events were invented between 1920 and 1945 as completely new events to sort of spur forth a circus-like mentality to sort of up revenue and get more people interested in the sport.
Yeah, well, I like this. I've been doing a lot of research on this, and I found this perspective from the organization Showing Animals Respect and Kindness, SHARC. They say traditional ranch work has been perverted into a spectacle of animal abuse disguised as, quote unquote, Western tradition. Today's rodeos bear little resemblance to ranch work, where care was taken to not injure animals. Modern rodeos are nothing more than Western themed circuses with contestants wearing John Wayne costumes and racing around the clock in a cruel spectacle for cash prizes to all sell sugar water, alcohol, and automobiles to the fans. Now, as I mentioned, I hadn't been.
That's kind of how I feel about it. Yeah.
Actually, Caroline, you know about that. Is that sort of how you've seen it when you've been exposed to the rodeo when you used to live in Alberta?
Absolutely. That's what it's all about. This is our modern day gladiator ring. And these are our modern day superstars and heroes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you were talking about education. It's so difficult to even get the straight news. I mean, you certainly don't get it from mainstream media.
Well, speaking of mainstream media, we had the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation here in Canada, and the CBC broadcasts these wonderful documentaries that Caroline and I both love to watch on our computers at home. And I came across a documentary recently that was put out by the CBC this year called Cowboy Up. If you're in Canada, you can watch it by going on their website and searching for it. It's a film that explores and documents the upbringing of young men and women in Canada, which really shocked me, in this rodeo culture. I didn't even know there was a rodeo culture like this in Canada. This film really astounded me. I was shocked. I asked you to watch it, and Jen as well. And what were your impressions?
Well, so do we have an hour? I don't think so. I think we have about 8 or 10 minutes.
We have
but
time.
Let me just talk fast, because as I said, I am fired up. And I want to say, first of all, shame on the CBC for this entirely biased documentary. Now, they're really upfront on their website saying that they're trying to bring forward the point of view of the rodeo performers. But the problem is that only one segment of their interviewees speak English, and it's not the horses, and it's not the goats, and it's not the cattle. So the rest, all the athletes, the animals, are silenced, and nobody is interpreting for them. Nobody is speaking for them. And the counter views to the rodeo culture, which is huge in Canada, in my opinion, needed to be given an opportunity to come forward. Animal rights activists needed to state their views, and they were not invited to do so. And I just find that kind of reporting really disappointing from our national broadcaster. It was not a fulsome documentary in any respect.
Yeah, I have to say the angle, the focus of this documentary, and I guess it was probably, I'm not sure how long, these documentaries run about 42 minutes probably on CBC, so they did have to focus. It was a storytelling documentary, and it told the story of these teenagers, these kids that start up like that, that are ingrained in this rodeo culture and have training to become the best that they can be in what? Abusing animals. And what were your thoughts about that?
Well, many. Okay, just let me finish on the media piece for a minute, and we'll also come back to that. Is that, you know, in the media in general, where we get the rest of Canada gets our information about this rodeo culture, when, for instance, they're showing the calf roping competition, the calf is running for it. So this is a little baby calf, a few months old, running for its life. They're chasing it down. The rope goes over the neck. CBC, who covers this event, cuts. And you don't get to see the calf being pulled violently.
They cut the broadcast.
They cut the broadcast. They go to commentary. They go to a recap, or they go to a commercial. You never actually get to see the absolutely most violent event of the rodeo, in my opinion. And many of these calves don't get up. They have broken spinal cords. They have broken necks. They suffer great injury. How could you not? How could they not? So let me come back to this documentary for a moment, because, and I think that everyone just has to give it a watch. There's not one mention of animal cruelty, not one shred of sympathy for the animals. The goats, which are standing in here mm-hmm. for the calves, are thrown to the ground on their sides.
That's a goat with all tying their weight. Competition, right?
And this is a sport. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So this is painful, and you can see that it's painful. And they can't run away, by the way, because they're leashed. I had to watch it a couple of times. And then my partner Mark said, can't you see they can't even run away? They're leashed. Mm-hmm. That's not a real sport in any event. So, and also they profile this bucking competitions. And now what they don't tell you is that the reason these horses are bucking is that they have bucking straps put on their inside flanks and tied around their genitalia to promote this bucking. And it is, you know, if the horses don't buck well enough, they're sent to the slaughterhouse. And David, I'm going to come to you because you have a bit of information on those kinds of statistics. And horses that do buck enough are rewarded with more abuse because they get sent back into the ring again and again to have this strap put on them and to start bucking. And quite often they are given an electric prod in their anus or on their backside somewhere, on their nostril, on their lips, sensitive tissue. Now, this electric prod is very strong. It infuriates the animal, as you can imagine, and the horse comes out of the chute, or the bull comes out of the chute, bucking for their lives in a rage. They're full of fear, and this is considered entertainment in this country. So, you know, at one point in this documentary, this individual, this rodeo father says, oh, this horse loves to buck, you know, as if the horse itself is having a great time of it. And yeah. This is where I really have a problem with the horse's story not being told mm-hmm. because of that horse is not having a great time. Horses that are having a great time aren't bucking for their lives.
But you know who is having a great time? The kids. I mean, isn't that so strange that they would get such joy and a feeling of achievement by abusing animals, well, which they're not recognizing?
Yeah. Let me talk about that for a moment, because there is a whole culture around this event which says full of you are a superstar. Mm-hmm. You are macho. You are cool. If you're good at these events, you are you have status. Furthermore, sponsorships in university and college are tied, athlete level scholarships are tied to these events. So there are actually scouts sitting in the stands to reward these. Now, of course, I would say the animal is the athlete, but no, not here. It is the individual who stays on the horse and has some balance that is rewarded with these academic scholarships. Mm-hmm. So, of course, there's prestige built in to these events.
And these kids train long and hard, too. In the documentary, it was saying that the kids train every night until midnight on how to ride a bull and how to tie ropes around the goat. There was that one story, right? And the girl didn't quite make it, and it was really sad and unfortunate.
She didn't make it to the finals. And tears were shed in this particular documentary, and you feel for them in the moment. And then you think, oh my gosh, this is just a bizarre culture. And it starts at 3 years old. These kids are put on sheep, which are these, you know, 2 years old is a toddler, 3 years old. This is a very young child is with still fragile bones, and they're stuck on a sheep. The sheep is sent out of the chute. The sheep is running, as it would, and the child falls off. At 6 years of age, the children learn bull riding in earnest. So this is my opinion on this. This is the intersection of when child abuse and child disregard meets animal abuse.
Well, the thing is that we always talk about on the show here how children are born with compassion, but this is a way in which it is very quickly perverted into the views that most people as adults hold against animals.
I was going to say, actually, I had a couple of quick points related to that, but even the event itself is called mutton busting. They're referring to the live scared animal as the already consumable, supposedly dead product. And then they're indoctrinating young children to look at live animals as just eventually dead meat for our consumption. And that is so bizarre. But another related to something you said earlier, too, about how they cut away. CBC has Hockey Night in Canada in primetime. Children are exposed to bloody hockey fights. I grew up with that being socially acceptable, that kind of violence shown on the ice, a man falling onto the ground and raining down blows on somebody, but they're going to cut away from a calf. So I think the stampede also teaches us all these different things that go on that are absolutely heinous. They just don't say it out loud. It's just by their subtle actions that you can see, you can get so much more information, you know, like what you're talking about.
Exactly. And let's talk about hockey for a moment, because in hockey, parents do send their child out to engage in a pretty rigorous sport, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. they're given face masks mm-hmm. and helmets mm-hmm. and armor, body armor, and a lot of padding in order to protect them. And they have a referee
and like
who's out there.
And ancillary medical stuff, concussion testing and all sorts of.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. So parents are putting their children on these. And there were fantastical quotes in this documentary about, you know, a mother just saying, oh, broken bones, that's part of it. All the kids were sporting injuries and falling off yeah. and getting a broken wrist or getting a broken arm or getting a concussion.
They were saying it's inevitable if you're going to be in rodeo.
Exactly. Yeah. So the culture is such that you actually send your child out on a bucking bronco without a helmet, without any body armor, in order to do battle with this creature that is in pain. And then ultimately, you get thrown to the ground in almost every case. It's just a matter of how many seconds it takes. Do you get to the 8-second mark? Let's just think about that for a moment. Oh, yeah. And it's just, no, I just want to let that hang in the air. And that is the culture. No protective equipment whatsoever. Broken bones are normal. And the parents stand on the sidelines and cheer it all on.
Because what they're doing is a really great thing for society. And that's, from my alien perspective, is what baffled me. I mean, we're all animal activists here and social activists. We want to make change for the world, to make the world a better place, right? And in my mind, I'm thinking, if they put this much time and energy and effort into doing other things, like,
I know,
can't they think of other things to do?
Yeah, you know, that doesn't involve animal yeah. abuse.
Well, anything.
If you want to break bones, you could always try motocross. You know?
I'm sure there's a whole documentary about that, too. Yeah, but it doesn't involve animals.
Motocross, it's only willing participants. And in rodeo, you have some unwilling participants.
Yeah, for sure.
I wanted to note also that in the documentary, there was a big banner. And one of the primary sponsors of these events, and the banners on the inside of the ring, is called Cruel Girl. Now, I went to the website and I looked at Cruel, C-R-U-E-L.
Cruel.
Yeah, Cruel Girl. And this is a brand. It's a clothing brand. And their ethos is that, you know, when you go to their website, is that this is basically that cruel is cool. The sassy girl. So there's a culture of embracing this cruelty as being cool.
And it's Western wear clothing.
It's Western wear clothing. It's rodeo clothing called Cruel. They could just call it Cruel Wear, but it's called Cruel Girl.
They're not just hiding it. They're rebranding it.
They're
cruel is
they're
cool.
owning it.
Exactly. Wow. So I want to talk about singer Jan Arden. What do you have to say about that, Jan?
Well, for those who don't know, Jan Arden was given the position of Stampede Parade Marshal along with musician Paul Bryant. And Jan Arden's Facebook wall quickly filled up with comments from both supporters and animal rights advocates who were previously fans of her and were quite surprised at her promotion of the Calgary Stampede. And I have to say, I read all of the comments that were critical of her, and none of them were bullying. They were quite kindly worded, I thought, saying, you know, I'm a big fan and you're a really compassionate person, and in the past you've spoken out against the cruel chuck wagon races. Jan, please reconsider. I was noticing that she wasn't responding to any of these comments, and they were going on for days. So finally, I wrote her a direct letter and I said, would you please respond to the comments? We just want to know how you feel. And so if we have time, I can read out her letter.
Perhaps you can read some highlights of it. Okay. For sure. Yeah.
So she basically said she's appearing in the parade for her city and the people of Alberta who've been pummeled by the recession, wiped out by fires and lost everything they've worked for. She says, I'm appearing in the parade that, yes, is part of the Calgary Stampede, but also part of a much larger and broader spectrum of activities and events. I'm not supporting animal cruelty. I would never condone or promote the abuse of an animal. I can take the bullying, and really I can. And this is coming from people wearing leather shoes and eating hamburgers and waving their fingers at me like I'm solely responsible to stop a rodeo that's been going on for 100 years. People have been ridiculous on social media saying I don't do enough and that I'm a hypocrite. I wonder what these very same people have done to improve the lives of animals. This is funny because we're all actually animal rights activists full time. To say that I took a private plane ride and rode a horse is to help the horse call, and that's about it is offensive and irresponsible. You have no clue what I do behind the scenes, none whatsoever. Stampede programs have done so much to nurture music and singing and dancing for thousands of kids over the years. The economy benefits. I found it quite a defensive letter, and in the end she finishes off saying that it's nothing more than a simple parade and she's no more promoting animal cruelty than strangling her own mother. Advocates know that, but they use her name to bring some kind of attention to their issues, she says. And then she finishes with, use me all you want. I know my work with animals and their welfare, and I don't need to be bullied into submission by people whose time could be much better spent doing the good they so desperately want to convey to the rest of the world. I'm not promoting a rodeo. I'm appearing in a parade for a city I'm proud of, for the hundreds of thousands of people and their kids who line up to sit on the curb and spend time forgetting about their troubles for an hour.
Oh, wow. You know, one thing that gets me to that, and you know, David, you can relate to, is that she says the parade has nothing to do with the Stampede. It has everything to do with the Stampede. I have been invited twice, also this year for next week, to perform in the parade as well, because I play in a band. And I've turned it down, obviously. Mm-hmm. You too, right, David? I mean,
totally. Yeah, to me, Jan Arden just sounds insensitive. Anyway, sorry, it had to be done.
It had to be done. Yeah. Sing it.
Anyway. We've in the past, I was in a band that toured a lot, and we've been asked about doing those shows or partnering up with other bands to do those shows, and everyone kind of already knew and just quickly looked at me, and I'm like, veto. So I've never
easy,
had to.
Right? Like easy, no yeah. duh decision. And yeah. with her, she's really standing up for it. And it's strange. I mean, Caroline, you mentioned earlier the term cognitive dissonance when it comes to Jan Arden.
Well, I hear a lot of cognitive dissonance in there. I hear a lot of actual pain. I think that on one hand, she does want to believe that she's a good person, and she probably is a good person, but that she wants to stand up for the city. And then there's this her attitude is one thing and her behavior is doing another. And I hear such amazing conflict.
She's acting like she's being victimized.
Not the only way to help Alberta. Oh, I'm sorry.
Sorry, you go ahead, David.
I was just going to say, she makes it sound like in subsequent comments, she makes it seem like that's the only possible way that you can help Alberta.
Have a free concert, Jan.
Yeah.
Have a concert series for free. Let's help Alberta.
Rodeos always have local musicians in part to save costs and provide entertainment, but to also make more money, to have people pay to become famous through the rodeo. So it's not a service they're doing of their own altruism.
And you could have the midway, right? You could have all the things associated with the thing without having the animal abuse.
Yeah, and hopefully we'll be seeing more of that in the future, when just like having the circus without animals, right? So I'm sure we could keep going on and on about this. This has just been a short look at rodeo culture, the rodeo itself, from the perspective of some people just really who just don't identify with the whole culture as being something that is good for society. Definitely not good for the animals, especially, you know, they're being used for reasons of entertainment and tradition, and we feel that that is wrong. And yeah, if you have any comments or questions or suggestions, post them on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver. I really would like to hear from our listeners more about the rodeo.
You are listening to Animal Voices on Vancouver's Co-op Radio, 100.5 FM CFRO. 100% listener-sponsored radio, broadcasting live from the east side on unceded Coast Salish territories.
And now for the news. The animal rights organization Direct Action Everywhere has released a new video showing an investigation and rescue on a pig farm. Former Baywatch star Alexandra Paul is featured in this rescue, and the footage contains images of piglets resorting to cannibalism due to stress and hunger, suffering from staph infections with large open wounds, and also shows images of adult pigs lying on top of one another, crammed into tiny crates, also suffering from large open wounds. The video can be seen at savingsmiley.com or directactioneverywhere.com.
Thank you for the news.
For our feature interview today, we have David Komenheide on the show. He is the executive director of the Humane League, a nonprofit organization in the U.S. whose mission it is to reduce animal suffering by inspiring change at all levels. Earlier this month, the United Egg Producers in the U.S. announced that it will be eliminating the practice of culling male chicks at egg-laying hatcheries by the year 2020, or as soon as it is commercially available and economically feasible. The Humane League played a large role in the negotiations of this decision, and David is here today to tell us about what this significant change in the egg industry will mean for people and the chickens. Hello, David, and welcome to the Animal Voices show.
Hey, thanks for having me. Very honored to be here.
Well, thank you for coming on the show today to talk to us about the end of this common practice in the egg industry, chick culling. But to start, I think it is not common knowledge among the public as to the fact that chick culling in the egg industry even exists. Culling is killing, and I think this is yet another aspect of the animal agriculture industry that is so disgusting that, of course, it doesn't want anyone to know about it, and so most of the public just doesn't. So to start, can you please shed some light to our listeners who may have never heard of chick culling before? What is it? Why is it done? And what are the methods used to kill the chicks?
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. It's something we find when we're doing our outreach and work with consumers that people are shocked by, and that most people just have no idea that this is going on behind closed doors. So the crux of the issue is that really there are two different breeds of chicken that are used for food. So we have the chickens that are raised for meat. The industry term is broilers. And these are animals that live a very short amount of time, typically just about a month, and they grow to be just grotesquely large. So they're grown and bred to just have a huge breast, to just have as much meat on their bodies as possible for industry to sell. However, the birds that are used for their eggs are a much smaller variety. They live much longer. They live for a year or more. And they are selected to just be egg-laying machines, essentially. And they're much smaller. They require less food. And they just pump out eggs at a very high rate. So that leaves the male chicks of the egg-laying variety as the odd man out, because they're not going to grow in a way that makes sense to raise for meat that will make money for industry. And of course, they can't lay eggs. So that leaves this issue for the hatcheries that sell to the egg industry, is that they have all these male chicks that are essentially useless. So the current practice right now, the standard practice in the U.S. and around the world, is to by hand sex the chicks after they've hatched. And in the U.S., they're disposed of either by macerating is the recommended way to get rid of them, and that's essentially throwing them live into a blender or wood chipper looking device that grinds them up while they're still alive, typically on the first day of their life. or to suffocate them or to gas them. So that's happening to over 250 million chicks each year. It's about 255 last year based on the USDA numbers. So just put that in perspective, that's 700,000 chicks every single day that are macerated or suffocated. And it's a horrifying practice, and we're glad to see it ending.
Yeah, so finally, there's a new technology that is now able to sex the eggs before they hatch. Can you tell us about how this works, please?
Absolutely. So we've been very excited in the last few months to see some really major breakthroughs in this. It's called in ovo sexing technology. So very early into the incubation of an egg that usually lasts about 3 weeks before they hatch, they're able to determine what sex the chick inside of the egg will become or what sex the embryo is. So there's a few competing technologies at the moment. The two that are leading, one uses a laser to cut a very small, precise hole into the shell of the egg, and then it bounces light off of the chromosome inside the egg using a laser and determines based on how the light bounces around whether it will be male or female. So a little over my head, but I'm glad that somebody understands how to do this. The other technology that has been devised uses a very, very tiny needle that also pierces the egg. And instead of using light, though, to bounce off chromosomes, it just measures the fluid inside of the egg. And there's a 2% difference in the DNA early on that can be measured very, very accurately. Both of these are about 95 or 96% accurate at just a week or so in to incubation, which means that there's no risk of any kind of developed, you know, consciousness or nervous system. It's essentially just like an inert embryo.
And do you know when sentience in a chick, in an embryo, occurs in an egg?
Yeah, I mean, this is certainly it's a mix of a science question and a philosophy question, I suppose. But from the research that we've done, it seems very clear that this early on, you know, in the first third or less of incubation, the embryo is so unsophisticated that there's no reasonable concern for suffering or sentience.
So from what I've read, I understand that these eggs that will be sexed as being a male chicken, they'll be pulled from the supply of eggs that go into the egg laying industry. And what will happen to them then?
Yeah, so this is for us one of the most exciting pieces of this new technology, is that not only will it be able to prevent the chicks from being born and then killed, what it's going to allow for is a huge reduction in demand on the current laying flock. So we're going to be able to sex these eggs very early on and then actually put them into the supply chain. Now, we're not talking about the eggs that you go to the supermarket and purchase, because those are not fertilized eggs. But there are many, many other ways that eggs are currently used. So just a few examples would be using eggs in the development of vaccines. So these fertilized eggs can be used for that. They can also be put into like the non-human food supply chain, so pet foods, other things like that. So we're talking about reducing a huge amount of demand, so much that based on our estimates, looking at the USDA numbers, about 950,000 egg-laying hens will no longer be required to be on factory farms. So not only are we talking about hundreds of millions of male chicks not being killed, we're talking about just overall reducing the number of animals suffering on factory farms, which is, of course, the real bottom line for us.
Okay, so I want to talk about that a bit more here. So I understand as well there's going to be a monetary benefit for the egg industry to implement this new technology, because it's going to be preventing all this wastage, right? So that means that hatcheries will instantly double their capacity in their incubators, since all the eggs going in will be going female. Now, you said that there's going to be a huge reduction in the demand for eggs, but from what I've read here, it also means that hatcheries will instantly double their capacity in their incubators. So does this mean is that we're going to be having twice as many eggs going into the incubators put into the egg laying industry?
My understanding is that the capacity of these hatcheries is not really the limiting factor in the egg industry. That seems to really depend on a few other economic factors, including just like the general public demand for eggs. So I think it's unlikely that a driving factor will be increased, you know, incubator capacity, because those are things that they could just easily build more of if the demand could just be pushed up artificially like that. Additionally, there's going to be a lot of other strain on the egg industry because of the essentially like nearly 100% commitment away from battery cages at this point, meaning that not only is there going to be a huge upfront investment in this egg sexing technology, all of the egg producers themselves are going to be investing in building more and more cage-free farms now and retrofitting older farms. So I don't anticipate some kind of drastic expansion in egg sales because of this.
Well, that's really interesting, because it seems that times are changing, and I want to talk about the end of battery cages as well. I understand that the United Egg Producers represents 95% of U.S. egg farmers, and you, the Humane League, you've been instrumental in negotiating with the United Egg Producers to implement the end of chick culling in the future, but you already have a relationship with them where you've also have been in negotiations with them to end battery cages. So I'm wondering if you could just sort of start from beginning to end and tell us how these negotiations were initiated and how has it come to the concluding result with regards to battery cages and chick culling coming to an end.
Sure. So our work on battery cages began, you know, 7 or 8 years ago on individual college campuses. And currently, cage-free eggs represent about 7 or 8% of the market in the U.S., I believe. And back then it was even much less than that. So I got my start going door to door on college campuses, getting individual cafeterias to go cage free, which would impact, you know, a few hundred or even a few thousand animals at a time. We spent our campaign's time on that program on campuses for about 4 years before we started launching national campaigns. Our first big national campaign was against Sodexo, the dining service provider, who works on college campuses, cafeterias, any place that has like large dining, like a sports arena, things like that, and hundreds and thousands of accounts around the world. And we were able, after about 4 or 5 months of campaigning, to get them to make a 100% cage-free commitment. From there, their competitor Aramark did, then the largest in that industry, Compass Group, did. Then we went down the line through manufacturers and restaurants and really a coalition of groups in the U.S. We're able to get essentially every major player, including McDonald's, Walmart, Costco, Kroger, everything, everyone you can think of that purchases lots of eggs. So right now the writing is really on the wall for the egg industry. And I will admit that our relationship with the UEP, the United Egg Producers, has been fairly contentious because of this ongoing campaign. But we had not directly negotiated with them too much. But we thought, in kind of the wake of this huge revolution on cage-free in the U.S., it would be a good time to approach them about chick culling. We knew that we wanted this to be kind of next on our docket of issues to cover because we saw this promising technology coming out, and we knew that we would be able to run a similar campaign as we had with cage-free to essentially get corporate policy saying we won't accept this past a certain date, just like with cages. But we approached UEP first and said, hey, listen, you know, we've had a contentious relationship in the past. We've had this ongoing campaign. Our preference, and we imagine your preference, is instead to work proactively together to get rid of this cruel practice. And we were really delighted that they decided that they wanted to be a leader on this issue and they wanted to come out and get rid of chick culling. So their board voted and decided to make this timeline and commitment with us. So yeah, it was a definite change in our relationship, but one that will thankfully benefit many animals. And it also allows us to, instead of having to focus on this as a campaign issue, move on to new areas for our campaign work and corporate work.
Well, here in Canada, it's also been recently reported that we're also developing this ovo-sexing technology, and the egg farmers of Ontario say that chick culling will be coming to an end here in Canada too. They say within the next 2 to 3 years. Can you comment on this?
Yeah, we saw that as well. We're delighted. We've also reached out to virtually every kind of egg board or egg producer council, or, you know, those kinds of bodies around the world. So we're currently in communication with many of these global bodies trying to get the same timelines in place. And indeed, we're hoping that even with these slightly more conservative commitments of a few years, like the UEP commitment, that it may be installed much sooner than we think. And it really is a question of getting the producers and the hatcheries in touch with the scientists, making sure that there is a company that buys the technology and the patents and produces the equipment. So that's the real X factor. We're doing our part in trying to connect those parties. And we've, since the news broke, we've been in contact with many of the scientists involved. I think it's clear the writing is on the wall that in the U.S. and Canada, this will happen very shortly. And we're hoping that we can carry this momentum, just like we have with battery cages internationally, and essentially just get rid of this practice around the world as quickly as possible.
Yeah, exactly. It would seem to make sense. Now, Germany was the first country to actually even make headlines in saying that they were going to take on this technology. But then their parliament just threw down that ban that had been implemented. What was that about?
Yeah, so Germany is one of the areas where this technology has had a lot of breakthroughs, and it's kind of shown that it can be a viable commercial technology, that it can be done cheaply enough and quickly enough for these, you know, massive hatcheries. And some of their politicians have been very supportive of trying to regulate and reform some of the curb the worst practices happening on factory farms in Germany. So this was one solution that was brought up to try and improve practices there. They did try to pass they did try to make it illegal and ban the practice of chick culling. So that was voted down, but that was a separate vote from the statements that were made saying that, you know, these non-binding statements saying this is something that we want to do. That it shows the difficulty of passing legislation to protect animals compared to working on corporate reform or getting commitments and timelines from these bodies of producers or from global corporations and so forth. So obviously it has the benefit of being binding and legal, but on the other hand is a much more difficult and kind of zero-sum game. So we've spent a lot of our time working on corporate policies for that reason, simply because of the difficulty and scale of passing laws, and because we feel like we can push for change in a much faster way using that method.
So you already commented that you don't think that the fact that the hatcheries will have more room in their incubators will double their capacity. And I want to speak about the economics of supply and demand. I'm wondering, in this day and age, do you think there is even a market for more eggs in the industry when there's innovative companies such as Hampton Creek Foods that are slowly, I feel, starting to take over the egg industry? And even Hellman's Mayo has announced recently, you know, there was that big scandal with them trying to sue just mayo because it didn't include eggs and they said it wasn't mayo. Now, did you know that Hellman's Mayo is now starting mayonnaise without eggs because they are competing against the competitors rather than trying to sue them in court, which is just a silly thing. So what are your thoughts on just even supply and demand for eggs in the future? It seems like it's coming down.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I did see that news about Hellman's producing an egg-free mayo, which I was delighted by. I think that's a great position to be in where, you know, the kind of mammoths feel like to compete in the modern day, they need to be creating these kind of cruelty-free options. But more generally speaking, to the question about the demand for eggs, I'm not sure about Canada, but in the U.S., about 30% of the demand for eggs are not eggs that you would think of just like a fried egg or an egg sandwich or an egg that people would recognize as an egg or scrambled eggs, but rather are used in some other way, like a binding agent, let's say, or in baked goods or things like that. And these are areas where these technology companies, these food tech companies or innovative food companies have this huge opening where they can move in. And, you know, it's not hard to pick of the dozens of ways, chemically speaking, that eggs can be used in cooking. There are plants out there that can replace those. And these companies like Hampton Creek and what they've done with mayonnaise, and there's a number out there working on different kinds of products. I think that they have a huge opening here where a light is kind of being shown on the practices on factory farms and in the egg industry, things like caging and chick culling and so forth. And I think the time is really ripe for these companies to move in and start innovating and creating replacements that can just overall reduce the demand. So I think that that's where the biggest vulnerability is right now in the egg industry, is for these kind of that 30% in the market. Outside of that, I think time will tell, but I think that increasingly we're seeing people caring about where their food comes from. They're caring about not just sustainability, but sustainability being associated with the treatment of animals. And these things only spell to me reduced demand for animal products because of the realities for animals that are raised for food.
Well, thank you for that. And just before we go here, you recently announced a next phase in the Humane League Labs, which really interests me. And I'd love to have you on the show later in the year to talk more about this. But perhaps you can just give us a little teaser at this point about the Humane League Labs. What is it?
Sure. So the Humane League Labs is the research branch of our organization. And what we try to do is answer some of the questions that we have as activists, and as advocates. So, for example, when we're talking about farmed animals, one obvious question that comes up is, do we want to talk about, happy animals and how much pigs are like us and what they do in the wild and how resourceful they are and how many relationships they have and so forth to try and cultivate, warm feelings about animals? Or do we want to focus on how they suffer and how cruel factory farms are and so forth, and use sad images and upsetting images and bloody images? And the fact of the matter is that not only is this an important question for our advocacy, because one is likely much more effective than the other, but that there's also an actual answer out there. And just like a political campaign or a marketing firm would try to figure out the best way to persuade people, we believe that we owe it to the animals to take the exact same approach. So we've done a bit, mostly using surveys and split testing online, a bit of research in the past to try and determine, what kind of cover is most effective for a booklet that you're distributing, what kind of foods do meat eaters find most appetizing that don't have meat. So, is it better to talk about something someone already knows, like pasta and red sauce, or should we talk about, an analog for meat like a veggie burger? So all of that is available on our website, all the current research that we've already done at humaneleaguelabs.org. And we're launching a new phase now where one of our board members, Dr. Harish Sethu, who has an extensive background in research and numbers, and he runs the Counting Animals blog as well. It's another really great resource. And he's going to be taking the helm. We're going to be hiring a full-time researcher. And the first two studies that we have lined up are posted on that website. We're going to be doing a lot of UI testing and split testing of online videos for online ad programs that many groups use. And then down the line, we're also going to be doing some measurement, not through survey research, but through actually measuring people's behavior. So, for example, using outreach interventions like leafleting or online ads, and then actually tracking purchasing through supermarkets or through coupon usage and so forth to actually determine how people's behavior has changed, not just their self-reporting. So we're trying to create much more sophisticated and informative research than anything that's been done before is our hope. And just like always, all of the information will be public, posted online, our methodology, all of the raw data, so that not just the Humane League, but all advocacy organizations can try and learn from the research.
Well, thank you for coming on the show today, David, to speak to us about the recent announcement by the United Egg Producers, who are committing to end chick culling in the egg industry in the U.S. by the year 2020, and to tell us a bit about your project, the Humane League Labs. To find out more about the work that the Humane League does, please visit the website, thehumaneleague.com. Thank you so much, David. And will I see you at the AR conference next week?
Absolutely.
Oh, great.
Looking forward to it.
So you have been listening to Animal Voices on 100.5 FM Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Canada. Please join us on next week's show, Friday, July the 8th. We'll be doing a segment called Do Plants Have Feelings? And we'll be discussing the ethical dilemmas and that consideration of this issue may result in. Please check us out at animalvoices.org. We're going to be ending the show here with two songs dedicated to the chicks and the chickens. I think you'll like this, Caroline, because it involves chick sounds. We like making animal sounds here. Do you, well, chick sounds. Do you know how to say how chicks peep in Spanish?
No.
Pio, Pio, Pio. So this is a song that I grew up with. My mom sang called Los Pollitos Dicen Pio, Pio, Pio. You know Spanish. So
lovely.
Okay. And pollito is a chick. Pio, Pio, Pio is a sound that they make in Spanish. And a quick translation here. The baby chicks say Pio, Pio, Pio when they are hungry, when they are cold. The mother hen finds the corn and the wheat. She feeds them and keeps them warm. And we'll be following that with the song called Chicken Song by Will Tuttle. Stay tuned for Radio Shock with Alex Smith. Thank you so much for tuning into Animal Voices today. And remember to be kind to the animals.